draw on Sweet Night by John Wilby, performed by Stile Antico and the viol consort Fretwork in that lunchtime chamber prom from Cadogan Hall in London. It was introduced by Petroc Trelawney and first broadcast in August 2016.
The BBC Proms 2020 on BBC Radio 3. Our season, featuring musical greats from the past and present, continues with a concert from 1994, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. Two mighty works by Brahms, the Sunny Second Symphony and Brahms's Fourth Symphony, which Giulini had studied as he hid underground from fascists during the Second World War. Carlo Maria Giulini conducts Brahms this Tuesday evening at 7:30 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Next this afternoon on BBC Radio 3, it's time for this weekend's edition of the Early Music Show with Hannah French.
We begin today at St Stephen Walbrook. It's a church in the heart of the City of London, right opposite the Bank of England. The original building was Saxon, possibly built as early as the 8th century, dedicated to the first Christian martyr and certainly written about in the time of William the Conqueror. Walbrook refers to a stream, one of London's hidden rivers, that now runs its course under the road outside. Once the church stood on the east bank, then in 1430 it was rebuilt on the west, and that's before it was destroyed in the Great Fire of 1666, but became one of the first and largest city churches to be rebuilt by Christopher Wren, who lived next door. It's beautifully airy, flooded with light from windows all round the central dome, and it's also the resting place of John Dunstable. To peer deeply into the past to see anything of Dunstable's life, but like this church, there are hidden clues. He was buried here in 1453, we know that. The original epitaph described him as an astrologian, a mathematician, a musician and whatnot. Then, after the Great Fire destroyed pretty much everything here, a replacement epitaph dubbed him Prince of Music. And that's no throwaway compliment, because as we'll hear today, he was an innovator, an influencer, in fact, the leading English composer of his generation, who, like Wren did for St Stephen Walbrook after the fire, created works of great beauty, such as this, another setting from the Song of Solomon, Quampulchre Es.
Oh,
Geoffrey Webber conducted the choir of Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge, in John Dunstable's exquisite Quampulchre S. 2 minutes in which, via the magic of radio, I've returned home to my stack of Dunstable CDs. And the sensuous imagery from the Song of Songs Dunstable set here was really his most declamatory style. The rests, pauses and chromatic colour are a real contrast to the austere atmosphere created by contemporary medieval liturgical composers. Now, this is just the sort of thing that sets Dunstable apart as the leading English composer of his day. But there's a specific innovation in here too, something that can't be underestimated and earned him an enviable reputation at home and abroad for transforming music into a new expressive art. The idea of using successions of sweet-sounding thirds had long been enjoyed by English musicians, but what Dunstable did was he added a third voice singing the fifth above it to make a resonant triad. Now, as we heard there, when triads appear on different degrees of the scale, this creates all sorts of new harmonies. And stick with me on this, because hearing it in action is enough to understand how, when Dunstable combined these triads with his mastery of word setting, he set the musical world alight. In 1442, Martin Lefranc wrote how continental composers Guillaume Dufay and Gilles Banchois were gripped and adopted this new method from the English school, and Dunstable specifically, because the wonderful delight makes their song joyful and remarkable. Such influence, but without a coherent life story to tell, where do we start in dating Dunstable's surviving works? And to add to the confusion, they're mostly scattered in manuscripts across Europe, places he may have, or definitely did not, spend time. Quampulchre S is thought to be a relatively early piece because it appears in a manuscript of various works from 1430. But there are records of performances, or possible performances, that suggest he was writing much earlier. And so we enter the court of Henry V, in which a wealth of music was required for services wherever the entourage happened to be, whether at home or in the fully functioning musical chapel that accompanied military campaigns.
Thank you.
Dunstable's motet Praeco Praeheminentiae, sung there by the Banchois consort, directed by Andrew Kirkman. It's a work which might just have been sung in Canterbury Cathedral in August 1416, when Henry V and Emperor Sigismund signed the Treaty of Canterbury, forming an alliance against the French post the Battle of Agincourt. Or maybe not. But the topic would fit. It's dedicated primarily to John the Baptist, but the text hints that it also celebrates the king's brother, John, Duke of Bedford, and his defeat of the French. Just as John the Baptist heralded Christ, Henry's brother led the English navy to victory and prepared the way for the king. In the balance of Henry's rule, this liturgical music signified the order, ceremony, and devotion required for a monarchy. Three elements that are also key to the structure of this next piece by Dunstable, his Veni Sancti Spiritus. And the number three continues to be significant because this is an isorhythmic motet. And here's how it works. In the first section, a rhythm is sung in the tenor part. Don't worry, you don't have to remember it. Then in the next section, it appears 1.5 times as fast. And in the third, twice as fast as the original. The effect is one of forward propulsion. And this is Dunstable, the musical mathematician. So add to that the three different texts sung by the upper voice parts, quite the norm for medieval musicians. But here they may also allude to the Father, Son and Holy Spirit. On paper, it's clever. In practice, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
The Gesualdo Six, directed by Owen Park, in Dunstable's motet for Pentecost, Veni Sancte Spiritus. Like Praeco Praeheminensiae, this is an intricate polyphonic work in which three texts, including the hymn melody Veni Creator, are combined, creating various dialogues and swirling florid gestures, alluding to the mysteries of the Father, Son and Holy Spirit. It was almost certainly first used in services at Henry V's chapel, but there's a strong suspicion this motet was also performed at the coronation of the very young Henry VI, first at Westminster in 1429 and then at Notre Dame in 1431. The hymn Veni Creator was an essential element of the coronation ritual. But add to the mix Dunstable's Mass, Da Gaudiorum Premia, which takes text from the hymn, and you have the ideal coronation repertoire. Strengthening this, in the Kyrie, Dunstable inserts the Rex Genitor phrase, instead of the usual Trinity one, to emphasise the parallel of the earthly and heavenly monarchy.
Thank you.
The Credo from John Dunstable's Missa da Gaudiorum Premier, performed there by Tonus Peregrinus and director Anthony Pitts. Music for the coronation of the only English monarch to also be crowned King of France, Henry VI, or second as he was in France, a ceremony that took place in Notre Dame in 1431. But had this music been heard earlier, at his English coronation perhaps, or even earlier, the political tone suggesting the 1420 Treaty of Troyes, which secured that French succession, or even for the marriage of his father Henry V to Catherine of Valois in the same city's cathedral. That happy Anglo-French union took place on the 2nd of June, Trinity Sunday, so the themes are still bang on. And in that light, the text becomes a peace treaty, a polyphonic plea to God to give the rewards of joy, give the gifts of grace, loosen the chains of strife and tighten the bonds of peace. Was Dunstable there in France, writing and directing this music, and following that success, asked to repeat it for the coronation? I'd certainly like to think so. And it's safe to conclude that England's foremost composer was in the thick of music for royal occasions of the greatest significance. Henry V's new French wife was crowned on the 23rd of February 1421 and became the first English queen to bear the name Catherine. And this was significant. Saint Catherine was one of the most popular saints of the Middle Ages. She's the one we normally associate today with the Catherine Wheel, the firework named after one of the horrific means of torture she faced. Her holy wedding to Christ made for an obvious and useful analogy to her namesake's marriage to the English monarch, which was a planned resolution of the Hundred Years' War with the French. It's thought that a new account of St. Catherine's life was written in celebration of the nuptials, and key images from her legend were on display at the grand banquet that followed the coronation ceremony. Dunstable was again on the case, writing a number of works in praise of the Virgin Martyr, such as this, his devotional Gaude Virgo Catarina.
Thank you.
the Banchoir Consorts, directed by Andrew Kirkman, with Dunstable's Gaude Virgo Caterina. The figure of St. Catherine was the perfect medieval role model. Detailed tales of her virtuous, compassionate and courageous character, of her dramatic life, winning arguments with philosophers and resistance to death, to say nothing of the crucial aspects of her beauty and nobility, ensured her an enduring reputation. She was a relatively late addition to the roster of virgin martyrs, but she overtook them all combined in popularity. Not only was she a bride of Christ, but her story included actual nuptials. This made her the patron saint of marriage. And with the royal wedding of Henry V to Catherine of Valois, a veritable Catherine cult rose in England, her name spreading throughout society. The chant Virgo Flelator was a response associated with St. Catherine and very likely woven into music used at Queen Catherine's wedding and coronation. Its text describes how the Virgin, imprisoned and awaiting torture, is bathed in heavenly light and sweet perfume as hosts of angels sing, and Dunstable uses portions of it in his grand motet Salve Schema Sanctitatis, in which he tells the full story of Catherine's martyrdom in graphic detail. Once again, there are three texts in play here. The upper part describes her torture, the people who gather, and Catherine's virtuous reactions, while the middle part focuses on the moments of martyrdom, the shining white blood that flowed like milk, and the pleas for her intercession. And the final, lowest part simply sings the line, "The heavenly hosts sing praises." Dunstable's Salve Schema Sanctitatis, sung once again by the Banchois Consort under the direction of Andrew Kirkman. As we keep trying to find Dunstable in the corridors of history, we'd seen the best bets to look in royal or at least noble households. Earlier we heard about a possible connection with the king's brother, John, Duke of Bedford, through the motet Praeco Preeminentiae. Now, Bedford owned rights to choosing clergy at St Stephen's Walbrook, which is where we started today, and where Dunstable would eventually be buried. And on an astronomy document, Dunstable is described as his personal musician. The Duke also formerly owned lands in Normandy before they were granted to Dunstable, suggesting that the composer possibly accompanied Bedford during the Regency of France from 1422, incidentally a time in which he'd have had plenty of opportunities to meet and influence composers at the Burgundian court. Then there's his name itself. I've been saying Dunstable because that's how it's spelt on most manuscripts, but it can be spelt in all sorts of ways, second most common being Dunstable, like the town, in Bedfordshire, the same Duke's county. It would appear that he knew how to operate in high society. He was also patronised by the Dowager Queen Joan. Her gifts and payments span the years 1427 to 36, and tax records from 36 show that in addition to these, he had a large income from properties in Normandy, but also Cambridgeshire, Essex and London. Then, after her death, it would seem he was connected with Henry V's youngest brother, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. And that brings us to a man who connects all these people. And to meet him, figuratively at least, I need to go find my car keys, because we're off to St Albans.
Thank you.
Dunstable's motet Dies Dignus, sung there by the Orlando consort. It's another isorhythmic piece in which the two voices, each with their own texts, weave their lines around a tenor part, which is repeated using decreasing note values. But what's striking is the sense of flow Dunstable achieves as he honours St. Germanus of Auxerre, a key figure in influencing Christianity in 5th century Britain. Significant because I've just parked outside the cathedral at St. Albans, and it was here that St. Germanus initiated the cult of St. Alban. But he's not the one I wanted you to meet. No, the link man in our fragmented story is Abbot John of Wheat Hampstead. He came to school here, entered the abbey when he was just 16, and became abbot in 1420. Wheat Hampstead was plugged into networks, highly educated, and seems to have had endless energy. Not only was he acquainted with Dunstable, he was closely associated with Queen Joan, with Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, and also with Italian humanist circles. It may well be through his and Humphrey's connection with Lionello d'Este that Dunstable's music's turned up in Ferrara in northern Italy. But Wheat Hampstead was creative too. He adapted the Latin text from a poem, Albanus Rosio Rutilat, that had been written for St. Albans and which Dunstable set, quite possibly for a visit to the abbey by the king's other brother, John, Duke of Bedford, in 1426. Well, I've just come into the cathedral through the new Welcome Centre. It used to be the chapter house, and before that, a monk's graveyard. In fact, when they began the conversion with preliminary archaeological digs in 2017, they actually discovered Wheat Hampstead's body, quite an unexpected find. Now, Wheat Hampstead had a plan for a magnificent library to be built at the abbey in 1452 and to include a set of 12 stained glass windows, each devoted to the different branches of learning. The monastic buildings were destroyed in the dissolution of the monasteries, but if I follow my directions carefully, yes, here in the north transept, by a spectacular rose window, are some of the original heraldic shields reset into new windows. Now, Dunstable was referred to in some of the verses the abbot composed for each window, not just the musical one, but also astronomy, medicine, and astrology. And this is something we've skirted round today, but Dunstable's ideas and writings survive in manuscripts in his own hand and references in others. See, as a whole, his was a life of codes, signs, and hidden meanings. Like this, a canon left in puzzle notation. Dunstable's puzzle canon, in which the performers have to deduce the music from clues in an enigmatic score, realised there by Giovanni Antonini and Il Giardino Armonico. Dunstable died in 1453. That we know for sure, because Abbot John of Wheat Hampstead wrote his epitaph, describing how, on the day before Christ's birthday, his star passed over into the heavens, and his Prince of Music was laid to rest at St Stephen Walbrook. Dunstable had been renting a property in the parish since at least 1445, but prior to that, there remained so many basic questions about his life, where he lived, when and with whom, his engagements and posts. The fact that we know that it was a life with so many interests, connections and pursuits doesn't really help piece it together. Variant spellings of his name also raise options that he may have been connected with a number of institutions. But there are a few last ones we can discount, owing to final records at St Stephen Walbrook. There are women sharing his name on the parish register, which would discount Dunstable from being canon of Hereford, an Augustinian at Dunstable Priory, or a monk here at St Albans. His first epitaph was burned in the Great Fire of London, but later an inscription by John of Wheat Hampstead describes how Dunstable, another Michaelis, the new Ptolemy, the younger Atlas supporting the Ark of the Heavens, rests beneath the ashes. It's possible that many of his compositions were burned too, or simply lost over the years, but copies continue to turn up around Europe, where, as the great 15th century musicologist Tinctorius described, Dunstable was considered a first among equals, often credited alone with innovations for which the English school as a whole was responsible. In 1904, the formal epitaph was reinstated in the church, quoting Wheat Hampstead's words and reflecting Dunstable as astrologian, mathematician and musician. A composer who had a secret knowledge of the stars, who clearly loved the mathematics and mysteries of the natural and spiritual worlds, and whose secrets continue to be fathomed. On paper, his works can look formidable. In performance, the magic's revealed. And in that spirit, I'll leave you with a piece Dunstable left in puzzle notation. Think the musical equivalent of a cryptic crossword, and which was solved a few years back by Professor Margaret Bent. Tonus Peregrinus sing John Dunstable's Gloria in Canon.
Thank you.
John Dunstable's Gloria in Canon, sung there by Tonos Peregrinus, directed by Anthony Pitts. And that brings to an end today's edition of the Early Music Show, which was presented by Hannah French and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. Next Sunday, Lucy Skeeping will be back with highlights from this summer's International Organ Festival in Nuremberg. That's at the usual time, 2 o'clock.
The BBC Proms 2020 on BBC Radio 3. Our Beethoven symphony cycle continues with another favourite, his 6th Pastoral Symphony, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra and conducted by its much-missed president, Sir Colin Davis. Join us for another classic prom this Thursday evening at 7:30 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 3 o'clock. Time now for Choral Evensong, which was first broadcast live on Wednesday from St Martin in the Fields in London's Trafalgar Square. The service is part of our month-long Choral Evensong residency at the church, which is hosting a number of London-based professional choirs over that period. Today's service is sung by members of the BBC Singers. The canticles are sung to the setting in B-flat by Charles Villiers Stanford, and the anthem is Behold, O God, Our Defender, verses from Psalm 84, set to music by John Scott, the former organist and choirmaster at St Paul's Cathedral and subsequently at St Thomas's Fifth Avenue in New York, who died 5 years ago on Wednesday. The service opens now with an introit by the sister and brother duo Elizabeth and Thomas Coxhead, My eyes for beauty pine, my soul for God's grace.